Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, the loss of smell and taste after contracting COVID-19. But up front, when the pandemic hit Pennsylvania and mitigation orders closed schools and businesses, many workers suddenly found themselves out of work. The State Department of Labor and Industry quickly ramped up unemployment online access, but the system became overwhelmed and difficult to navigate for some people. Nearly a year has passed, along with three federal stimulus plans to help offset the financial impact to workers. Has the current labor and industry compensation system been able to meet the challenge? Joining us is Pennsylvania's acting Secretary of Labor and Industry, Jennifer Barriere. Secretary Barriere, pandemic emergency unemployment compensation and pandemic unemployment assistance. Where are we with these programs today?
Hi, yes, good morning. So it's been a very crazy ride for the department since March 15th, which we consider the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the two programs that you just mentioned were basically originated from the original Federal CARES Act, which was signed into law on March 27th. Those programs were set to expire on the 26th. However, Congress and the former president signed an extension into law the day after it expired, kind of throwing us into a little bit of a whirlwind because there was a lapse in these programs, a day lapse. So, we had to wait for guidance from the Federal Department of Labor so that we could make changes to our system because there were new requirements added to these programs. So we worked fastly and furiously and are happy to say that we have these programs up and running. There are some glitches where some folks are experiencing some technical difficulties, but for the most part, individuals are getting paid under these programs currently.
Just for context sake, would you explain what each program is supposed to do?
So the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program is a new program, and that program was meant to provide benefits to individuals who were never eligible to receive regular unemployment compensation before. These individuals are gig workers, contract workers, owners of businesses, individuals who were impacted that, would not be eligible for unemployment benefits under the regular UC system. The program is not meant to be permanent. In fact, it requires federal legislation for it to be extended. So, there's a little bit of uncertainty as to, how long we're going to be continuing this program, which has presented its own challenges. The other program is the Pandemic Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program, and that program is actually an extension program that provides individuals, claimants, an extension of their benefit weeks when they've completely exhausted their traditional benefit weeks. So far, under both programs, we've paid out over $9 billion, which is a lot of money.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk@witf. That phone number is 1-800-729-7532. Secretary, I want to get some of the numbers out of the way before we talk about some of the issues and how they've been fixed and the advice that we can give to those who may have had some problems. How many people are currently eligible to receive assistance under one of these programs?
So since the beginning of the pandemic, we have had approximately 5 million Pennsylvanians apply for regular unemployment compensation and the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program. They're pretty much equally divided as far as the number of applicants who have applied for each program. The Pandemic Unemployment Assistance Program is a little bit different because it has very specific requirements in order for you to be eligible, and those have to be pandemic-related requirements. So, it's not not everybody is eligible. Just because you're not eligible for UC does not make you automatically eligible for PUA. So that's kind of presented its own challenges. Currently, just to let you know where we are, we have approximately a little more than 500,000 regular UC claims being filed each week. And as far as PUA, we're looking at over 400,000 Pennsylvanians who are filing for PUA as well.
Now, when you say 500,000, do you mean that those aren't new claims? That's the number, total number of people who are filing claims who are eligible that week, correct?
Correct. That's the average number of Pennsylvanians who are filing each week.
As far as new numbers go, do we have an average over the past month or so have we seen any kind of trends?
So this is for regular unemployment compensation. This is typically our busy season. So we've seen a little bit of an uptick because of seasonal employment. This is typically when individuals who are in seasonal employment collect. But we're probably averaging currently about, I'd say around 42,000, 43,000 new claims a week for regular UC. For PUA, it's a little bit different because of the eligibility requirements, but I'd say we're probably averaging about, 30,000 a week as far as new claims. But I'm predicting that many of those individuals may not be eligible for the PUA program.
Why do you say that?
Because of the very specific requirements that the federal government has imposed on that program. Mm. There are 10 specific requirements, and if you'd like further information, we have those requirements on our website.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask you all 10, but you mentioned earlier that the federal government changed some of the requirements. A lot of it had to do with residency, didn't it?
As far as changing the requirements, I think the idea was to combat the fraud that was taking place nationally. There was widespread fraud with this program. I think a lot of the new requirements are basically proving that you have the work history that you're claiming to have and that you indeed are eligible for the program.
Looking at big picture here, do we know how many people or have an estimate of how many people are unemployed in Pennsylvania right now? And I'm
so,
not just asking
what we have right now.
I'm not just asking about related to the pandemic, but overall.
So, what I have is a rough estimate, roughly 5.1% of Pennsylvanians who are working age population, which is between the ages of 16 and 65, those individuals are currently unemployed. So 5.1% is what we're estimating.
Does that include, because I know with regular unemployment statistics that sometimes that doesn't include those who have stopped looking for work. Does that 5.1% include those people?
It may not.
So usually that means there are more people out of work than what the percentages would show. All right, let me get back to some of the issues having to do with the pandemic. We still hear about some people who haven't received any assistance since the program has restarted. Or maybe even those, and I don't know how rare this is, but you still every once in a while hear about someone who hasn't gotten anything in the entire year. What are the issues with people not receiving any assistance since the program's restarted? And what about those who have just fallen through the cracks and have not gotten anything?
So, I wouldn't characterize it as falling through the cracks. I mean, the reality is not everyone is eligible for unemployment compensation or for the PUA program, unfortunately. There's going to be individual cases that require a little bit more research, require more facts for us to look into their claims a little bit further to find out whether they are eligible or whether they're not eligible. The problem is we can't just pay everyone who's claiming unemployment. We have to do our due diligence. It's a federal law. It also has some state requirements as well. We need to make sure that we're legally carrying out these programs, because if we don't, we could potentially get dinged by the federal government and ultimately be end up liable for the wages that we have paid out inappropriately. So some cases require further fact finding, and there's a whole magnitude of reasons. These cases are very fact specific, so sometimes it takes time to work through these facts and figure out what's really going on. Unfortunately, though, there's going to be some individuals who just aren't going to be eligible for benefits.
Since last March, Secretary, how many people has labor and industry hired?
So when we started out before the pandemic hit, we had approximately 770 employees in our unemployment compensation program. We were staffed for a low unemployment rate. At that time, the economy was doing very well. We had a low unemployment rate, and we were meeting our statutory requirements as far as processing claims. When the pandemic hit, we were not staffed for the influx of claims that we received. But since then, we were able to amp up and currently we have 1,600 staff that can help address these programs. We are constantly hiring and bringing new people on board. And if I could give a shout out, our folks are doing an amazing job. These people are some of the hardest workers you would ever encounter. I mean, they are dealing with really tough situations, working 7 days a week, working a lot of overtime. They're very passionate about what they do. So I'd like to give a shout out to them. But, in the future, we are still planning on amping up our staffing. We still plan to continue hiring. In fact, this month, we're bringing 120 more customer service representatives on board. Next month, we're slated to bring on more. So we are going to continue to amp up so we can clear out these backlogs, get people their money, and also get claims resolved.
Is part of the problem, well, I know part of the problem is because the Auditor General said it was just a few years ago, is that the technology that labor and industry is working with is outdated. That was one of the issues that I saw it compared to 1970s technology. I don't know whether that's an exaggeration or not, but was that one of the issues with this onslaught of people who were unemployed and wanted to use the system, but the Department of Labor and Industry just didn't have modern technology?
So this is kind of a national problem that I hear from many of our sister states. A lot of us have very antiquated technology, and you are correct. Our current system is the black screen with the green dots. It is very outdated.
You're kidding me. No, wait, I have to interrupt for a second.
Pandemic is.
I have to interrupt for it. Are you telling me that the black screen with green dots, that you're still using that?
Yes, 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 we are. And, the unfortunate thing is we are actually currently undergoing a benefits modernization project, and we were slated to go live with that project this past October. But however, with all the new programs that we were hit with during the pandemic and having to create new federal programs, we had to push back that go live date. And we hopefully we'll go live with our new modern system that has all the bells and whistles, that's more intuitive, more user friendly. We hope to go live with that later on this spring.
I mean, I just want to make sure that we're accurate here. I'm sure there are some window based systems that you're using. But what in particular are you using? And that very much is 70s, early 80s type technology. What different programs are using that?
So that is our basic main claims processing system, which we call our mainframe. That is the black screen with the green dots. I mean, we do have more modern technology that we're using to address customer service needs. For example, we're using Microsoft Azure, which is helping us with with answering phone calls and screening through claimants. And we're also we also have a chatbot named Paula who's helping to provide a modern technology to our customer service. So we are using some modern technology, but unfortunately, our claims processing system is antiquated.
Wow. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Acting Pennsylvania Secretary of Labor and Industry Jennifer Barrier. If you have a question or comment about unemployment compensation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Secretary Barrier, we have a question from a listener looking for a clarification and wanted to know, he says that did he hear you correctly that over 5 million Pennsylvanians had applied for unemployment during the pandemic? And he says, according to Google, Pennsylvania's workforce is 5.6 million. Are these numbers correct?
Those are how many, there could be repeat claims. These could also be fraudulent initial claims. These are the number of initial claims that both of our systems have took in since March 15th. So there are some, there could be some numbers as far as individuals filing more than once. And again, the fraud issue had been something that we addressed, I believe, in the summertime. So yes, those numbers are correct.
There have been more than one issue. Now has been more than one issue in getting money to recipients. Just 2 weeks ago, you had a press conference, an update listing some of the changes that have been made. But what are some of the issues that have caused some problems or some challenges for those seeking unemployment compensation?
So, we are constantly monitoring social media and other avenues, and also, of course, we have our email accounts and our customer service centers that are answering phone calls. So one of the issues that I know that we currently have outstanding right now is a residency issue, a permanent residency issue with our PUA program that I believe we are working on a fix for. But essentially, these issues tend to be computer-related glitches. They're not through fault of the department. They're more programming issues. So we are working with our vendor, especially with our PUA program. We're working with our vendor GSI to iron out these issues and get them addressed as quickly as possible.
Just looking at some of the things that you talked about a couple weeks ago, link on a website that was causing some claims to appear inactive, that was removed, an issue causing users to get stuck in an endless loop that sent them to the main page. It was fixed, that your department said, but officials say they are still receiving reports of this issue and investigating further. Talk about that a little bit, if you would.
So, these issues, it's interesting, especially when you're, and please, I didn't go to school for information technology, so I'm using very layman's terms here. But, when you fix something, there's the potential that something else could go wrong. So when you're making changes to a computer system, that, that could eventually change something else that could spring another issue. So, we are working very closely with our vendor to get the loop issue addressed. It seems like these issues pop up and it seems intermittently, but we are closely monitoring them and working with our vendor to test and ultimately address these issues.
Secretary, one of the big frustrations that those who have applied and have not gotten what they are supposed to get, what they're eligible for, is that they just haven't been able to get through. There have been people, now I know that this was early on in the pandemic, and I wanted to find out if it's still occurring or not, but people who continuously were trying to call labor and industry were not able to get through, just had a busy signal constantly. Those going to the website that the website was just overwhelmed. Do those problems still exist? And the secondary question is, then if someone is having trouble getting through, they want to talk to a person, what can they do?
Sure. Thank you. You know, when we were looking much better in December, we were starting to catch up on our email accounts and the call wait times were getting better for us. But unfortunately, when the federal programs expired at the end of December, and there was that lapse and some uncertainty as far as to what the feds were going to do as far as extending those programs, that obviously created some issues for us. It not only created issues for Pennsylvania, but it created issues for all states nationwide. This is not a solely Pennsylvania issue. So we did experience an uptick in the number of calls and emails as a result in the lapse of the federal legislation. However, we are going to continue to bring on more resources, more customer service representatives to address this uptick. We've seen a little bit of a decrease since we've rolled out the new PUA program and also extended the PEUC benefits. My recommendation to individuals trying to get through to the department because they have an issue is to contact us via email. That is the simplest way for us to be able to address your issue and get back to you in a timely manner. My recommendation is when you send your email, put the last four digits of your social security number and explain to the best of your ability the problem which you are experiencing with your claim. And it makes it more easier for our customer service representatives to work through your issues and address it and be able to contact you. Another issue we have is please make sure you're available to answer your phone. If you see an unknown number, that's likely us. We have an issue with getting in touch with claimants. So please stay by your phone and please email us your issues. Those are my two recommendations.
And that email address is what?
It's two different email addresses depending on what program you are you're calling about. So for regular UC or the PEUC program, what you want to email is uchelp@pa.gov. And for the PUA program, it's ucpua@pa.gov.
And by the way, we have those email addresses on our website, wytf.org/smarttalk, under today's program. A few emails that we've received from our audience today. Amber is a Millersville University student, wanted to know, in response to unemployment and the pandemic, what's being done about those who refuse to go back to work when they are making more stain on unemployment? Is this considered fraud? Now, that was something that was addressed with the latest stimulus package when it went from $600 a week to $300 a week. But do you, and as labor and industry, have any role whatsoever in people who may decide, well, I'm doing okay with this unemployment compensation and I'm not actively looking for a job?
That's certainly a challenge. I don't like to presume anything as far as our claimants. I mean, this pandemic is real and it has had a real impact on Pennsylvanians. And I'd be remiss not to acknowledge that. Are there individuals who are reluctant to go back to work? Sure, but that could also be for pandemic-related reasons as well. I mean, there is a health risk to being around folks, and we want folks to remain healthy. However, we do acknowledge that the Pennsylvania economy needs to remain strong, which is why the governor has unveiled a back-to-work PA plan with his newest budget address this year. So, the governor is very passionate about upskilling individuals and preparing them for the workforce and getting them back to work as quickly as possible.
Frank from Lidditt says, I received a 1099-G form claiming I received payment for benefits. I didn't receive any payments at all, nor did I apply for any. What do people do for tax purposes to file on time when they're stuck with a fraud situation like this?
So, and this isn't, this is something that we've heard from. We do have information on our website as far as there's a form for you to fill out so that you can say that you received a 1099 in error, that you never received money. Please file that form and submit it. We received guidance from the IRS that you may file your taxes without having that form resolved. If it's a fraudulent form, just file your taxes as usual. Ignore the 1099 as long as you filed a fraudulent claim with the department.
Another tweet. Why are there hundreds of older people who did not receive pandemic assistance only because they received welfare benefits? How come those who decide who is eligible to receive those benefits do not take the time to check for this population?
This pandemic is something that we've never anticipated or imagined in our lifetime. There's no playbook. And I believe that the governor and this administration is trying as hard as possible to help as many people as they can. The UC program has a specific set of rules that it must follow, and either individuals are eligible or not. The department is responsible for implementing unemployment compensation. Other programs, I can't really speak to the eligibility for other programs.
Mm-hmm. One thing that before this pandemic, if we were having a conversation, Secretary, a lot of it would focus on workforce development or what we're doing to help people get back to work. That was before the pandemic. That doesn't mean that you stopped doing that. What is the department doing right now to try to get people back to work?
Thank you for answering that question, because that we still have continued to provide services during this pandemic. We have been in partnership with the 60 Pennsylvania Career Link offices located across Pennsylvania. We've worked with them to provide virtual services to Pennsylvanians, such as having a virtual lobby, being very cognizant as far as business closings. We really tried to work to make sure that virtual services are available so that individuals can still access training opportunities and also job opportunities as well. And I'd also very happy, I'd like to put a plug in. We've also recently announced the availability of $4.5 million to provide a digital literacy and workforce development grant to support local programs across Pennsylvania. And this is really important because these grants will enhance foundational digital literacy for job seekers and help them provide access to employment opportunities. So we continue to plug away with workforce development because we do recognize how truly important it is.
Are there industries, are there jobs that need filled now during the pandemic that maybe before the pandemic didn't?
We definitely have seen a swing in industries as a result of the pandemic. We've seen job losses in leisure and hospitality and education and health services. But in turn, we've seen an uptick in the gain for trade, transportation, and utilities. I highly recommend for anyone who's looking for job opportunities, please visit our PA CareerLink website. We currently have 133,000 jobs available across the state.
Are these good paying jobs? I mean, what you just described, transportation, utilities, they sound like, I mean, those aren't entry level jobs.
These are family wage sustaining jobs. And we're trying to prepare individuals for jobs of the future right now, making sure that they have the skills that they need to get to family sustaining jobs. So that's what we're working towards ultimately.
Secretary, has this pandemic changed the dynamic of seeking work, getting training, getting education? What has changed? Obviously, the unemployment compensation part of it is a big part of this, but has anything changed during this pandemic that we'll be taking it with us ahead to the future?
It's certainly changed. This pandemic has changed the landscape of Pennsylvania's workforce and needs. Prior to the pandemic, we had a really low unemployment rate and employers were finding it problematic to find employees. Currently, that's swung a little bit differently now. We have a larger pool of unemployed individuals and we still have the employer needs. So the pandemic is definitely forcing the agency and its CareerLink partners to look a little bit more strategically as far as what it's doing. We've had to pivot and figure out ways to best serve the increased sectors And we're continuing to monitor it. However, there is no playbook. So there's no predictive modeling. So we are just continue to monitor and react the best that we can at this point.
We had a listener ask if L&I is still hiring.
We always have job opportunities. Check our Office of Administration. We have, a jobs website on there. We'd be happy to bring you on board.
Pennsylvania's Acting Secretary of Labor and Industry, Jennifer Barrier. Thank you very much, Secretary, for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to take another look at how restaurants and taverns and bars are faring during the pandemic. And we know that many are suffering. A lot have gone out of business. What they're looking for, what kind of assistance and help they're looking for from government, state government, the federal government, where they are right now, the workers, where they are right now. That's coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in. The loss of taste and smell emerged early on in the pandemic as sort of a canary in the coal mine, especially if no other symptoms presented in the patient. The medical community agreed that these symptoms confirmed an almost certain case of COVID-19. A year into the pandemic, and some still haven't recovered their senses of smell and taste. And for a number of people who have, odors are now changed. Unpleasant scents have taken the place of normally good ones. A lot of questions here. And this is one of the more fascinating aspects of this COVID-19 disease or virus. Joining us today is Dr. Jonathan McGinn. He's a professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery with Penn State Hershey Medical Center. Dr. McGinn, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. McGinn, throughout the pandemic, I've spoken to a number of medical professionals about these very symptoms, and many times I've heard that we don't know why they occur. Let me ask you, I mean, we've had time now to study this. Do we know why the virus causes those infected to lose their senses of smell and taste?
Well, I think the jury still is out in terms of a definitive answer to that question. Interestingly, probably the most common source of people losing their sense of smell is after a viral infection. So we actually see this not uncommonly after people experience other types of upper respiratory tract infections, what we would call the common cold. And it's variable as well as in terms of how those patients recover and the length of time it takes and to degree that their sense of smell recovers. I think because of the significant amount of press and understandable concerns about everyone with the COVID pandemic, that this difficulty with sense of smell really has kind of come to a forefront at this point. But there does seem to be something different about this particular virus that has a greater chance of affecting the sense of smell than many of those other common viral illnesses. And so that isn't known entirely. We have some thoughts, and I think it's probably not the same in every patient. But the good news is, a lot of these patients, the vast majority of these patients do recover their sense of smell. There's fortunately only a small minority who persist in having that difficulty long term.
I noticed that you've said sense of smell. Do patients who have been infected, do they have both, or are there some that have one or the other?
Well, while most of us think of our sense of taste as being what happens in our mouth and our tongue, and our sense of smell is what happens in our nose, the reality is that they're really, really very much related. In fact, a large part of what we ascribe to being taste is actually our sense of smell. If you were to take an orange, for example, and close your nose and put the orange in your mouth, it would taste bitter, as well as a little bit sweet, depending on the version of orange, but you really wouldn't experience it as an orange. It's actually the aromatic qualities of the orange that you then perceive as this is an orange. And so when you lose your sense of smell, your sense of taste automatically is significantly impacted in a negative way. That's why many times when people have a cold, they'll do things like have soup and those type of things as their diet, not only because maybe there's some value to chicken soup, but really because soups tend to have a lot of salt in them and so forth. So when your sense of smell isn't working and your sense of taste technically still is in terms of what your tongue is doing for you, that salt from the soup is a little more flavorful and notable. So people enjoy that because they're at least getting something from what they're eating. But there does seem to be a small percentage of people that actually do have a measurable change in their tongue's ability to taste as well. There's definitely not any consensus on why that's happening at this point. I think the sense of smell loss makes a lot more sense. And the majority of people who are complaining of loss of sense of taste during the COVID pandemic, it's truly really their loss of sense of smell that's the major factor.
You know, I saw something online last week, and we all know that something you see online has to be true. But there was a story that said that there have been over 90 different symptoms reported with COVID-19. Now, I don't know how accurate that is. But when the pandemic first started, when it first came here to the United States, when it first was detected in China, it was described as a respiratory disease that it most affected the lungs. So it seemed like it was a bit of a surprise when there were people that were losing their sense of smell and subsequently their sense of taste. Is sense of smell somehow related to the respiratory system? You kind of touched on this.
Well, we oftentimes really describe the airway as all being one continuum from the tip of your nose to your lungs. The lining of your nose is very similar to the lining of your windpipe and your breathing tubes as they proceed to the lung. It has kind of the same microscopic structure to it and such. So the viruses that we typically see every year that cause what we would call a cold or a viral illness can equally affect the lungs, but many viruses have a tendency to affect one area more than another. This is one that, you know, was a little bit more equal opportunity in terms of it not only affected the lungs significantly, but also the nose. The one thing that's a little bit different about it is that most people with a cold recognize they have a cold. They've got a runny nose and a stuffy nose and so forth. And that sense of smell loss seems to be just a component of that. This situation, there seemed to be a greater incidence of people who simply lost their sense of smell with or without those lung symptoms, but didn't really have all of those other cold type symptoms that we normally would associate with a viral illness. And that does make it a little bit unique. So I would consider the nose part of the respiratory tract, absolutely. And I think it's because of some of that shared structure.
If you're just tuning in, our guest during this portion of the program is Dr. Jonathan McGinn. He's a professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery with Penn State Hershey. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. You could send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. As an aside, doctor, I have to ask, what is otolaryngology?
So otolaryngology is a surgical specialty that treats diseases of the ear, nose, and throat, as well as neck. Oftentimes, people refer to us as an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I think we just like the challenge of everyone trying to say otolaryngology.
Head neck surgery. I knew you were going to say that.
It definitely is a tongue twister.
Maybe that's a test for someone who is having a problem with their senses, if you could pronounce that as well. You know, this symptom has been described, the loss of smell, has been described as the best barometer to determine if someone has been infected. Is it?
I think, again, what makes it somewhat unique and therefore something that you can strongly associate with COVID-19 infection is the fact that all the other things that sound like COVID-19, meaning the other viral illnesses, just don't seem to have this as a dominant symptom. You know, we oftentimes hear about this positivity rate, you know, what your county's positivity rate is. And that really refers to, you know, people who have symptoms that are concerning, who then go and get tested. how many of them actually test positive for COVID-19. And in the worst case scenarios, the numbers are close to 30%, but many of our counties are in the 15% to even less than 10% range. And when you think about that, that means that the vast majority of people who are worried or concerned or have physicians and care providers who are concerned they might have COVID-19, in the end, they don't. Because there's lots of other illnesses that are going to give you a cough and shortness of breath and runny nose and sore throat and headache and muscle aches and pains, all the things that we also worry about in terms of COVID-19. But the majority of them don't have this particular symptom of loss of sense of smell, particularly in the absence of those other symptoms. And I think that's why it's been considered kind of a harbinger of concern when someone complains about that symptom, that indeed COVID-19 may be more likely.
There have been some who have even suggested that a smell test would be a better barometer than determining that a smell test would be a better barometer than taking a temperature as you enter a building or go into a room than getting your temperature taken. What do you think about that?
I definitely would not think I would take it that far. I mean, there are a reasonable percentage of the normal population that has some difficulties with their sense of smell. And so for that reason, I don't know that it would be super sensitive in terms of really picking up people. Additionally, the testing for your temperature is very quick and easy and expeditious, and I think pretty well defined in terms of how you do it. You use a thermometer and you know what the temperature is going to be. There's a single number that comes out as a result. Whereas the testing someone for a sense of smell is much more challenging. There are actually official smell testing kits that we can utilize in a clinical situation to evaluate the degree of someone's loss of sense of smell. It's not an absolute. It's not like I can or I can't smell. There's a lot of shades of gray in there. And it would be, it would take you 15, 20 minutes to test somebody's sense of smell adequately to really kind of assess whether their sense of smell is effective. And that's obviously not a great screening tool.
Yeah. We have another question from a listener who wants to know, does COVID have any connection to problems with ears or hearing?
Well, it's interesting. They're much like you mentioned before, that there's, a growing list of symptoms and problems that have been ascribed to COVID over the last years. We've been just learning more and more about the disease and how patients present and the problems they experience. There have been some recent reports of hearing loss associated with COVID-19. I would say it's a very small percentage of people. And again, the mechanism is not known. The challenge that we have is we have a growing number of patients who've either had or are currently experiencing COVID-19, that there are always going to be those random events that happen in a normal population of patients that are going to pop up in the symptomatic group, in the group that's actually affected. So sometimes the concern of cause and effect really starts to play a role. It's just because someone who had COVID-19 has hearing loss doesn't necessarily mean it was caused by the COVID-19. There may be other reasons. And that's why we don't want to put blinders on in medicine and naturally assume that just because someone had COVID-19 that a symptom or a problem they're experiencing must be related. But on the other hand, when we start to observe patterns and observe numbers of cases, then we start to raise the concern and people start to dive a little bit deeper. So again, the short answer is yes, there have been some reported cases, but I generally would not ascribe hearing loss as a easily recognizable symptom or particular concern for COVID-19 infection.
As you said earlier, and that's one of the things we wanted to talk about, is there are those COVID patients who have experienced what appear to be permanent loss of smell and taste. In a typical patient, and I don't know whether we have a typical patient now, but usually how long does the symptom last in someone who has contracted COVID?
So, the numbers have changed and been a little bit better refined over the last year. I mean, in terms of, even what percentage of patients are experiencing this sensation of loss or aberration in their sense of smell. I think we commonly will agree at this point that about 50% of patients worldwide who have a COVID-19 infection will experience some change in their sense of smell. which therefore means about 50% won't. And that's why, again, it's not a great screening tool. But the great news is that the vast majority of patients recover their sense of smell relatively quickly, even if it lags behind some of the other symptom improvements. So some of the recent studies have said that really by about a month, at least 50% of those patients who had experienced smell loss or smell changes will have recovered, and 75% by 2 months. The question becomes, what happens to the other 25%? After everyone's exhibited some patience and looking for that recovery? And the answer is probably closer to 10 to maybe at most 20% of people will have a long-term loss. And the challenge is really defining long-term, because, we've only been dealing with this for a year now. So even if a patient was one of the earlier patients experienced COVID-19, that's only been a year since they had that infection. And we know from other sources of smell loss, like those patients who develop smell loss after kind of more routine colds, it can take a year or more for some of those patients to recover. So we don't even know if that 10 to 20% is a real number or whether that will actually fall yet as we just get further out from the earliest patients experiencing it.
You kind of touched on this, but let me just ask the question again. Do we know why that 10 to 20% will experience long-term smell loss?
Well, again, I don't think we have a definitive answer, and there have been some ongoing projects looking at that particularly, as well as just drawing analogies from what we do know about other circumstances, other, again, viral infections that cause smell loss. I think the primary reason for a lot of patients, it's more of a mechanical issue. And what I mean by that is that your sense of smell actually comes from a very focal area, a very limited area at the top of your nose. And it's right at the kind of a peak of your triangular or pyramid shaped nasal passage. So it doesn't actually take very much swelling of the lining of your nose to really pinch that area off and prevent air from flowing there. And since your sense of smell is really a chemical receptor, it requires that the air with whatever you're smelling come in contact where the nerve fibers are. If you block that, then it's really not your sense of smell that's broken. It's the getting the air to your sense of smell. And that's something that actually can change relatively rapidly. And we suspect that many of the patients who experience short-term smell loss, whether it be from a traditional cold or in this case, COVID-19, it's more of that mechanical type process, which can kind of change quickly within a course of a week or two or even a month. The people who have more long-term smell loss, who don't really have a lot of nasal symptoms, we suspect that there may be some damage to the particular type of lining called the olfactory epithelium at that focal area in the nose. We're hoping that most of those patients are not actually experiencing damage to the individual nerve fibers that the sense of smell truly comes from, but more the cells that surround those nerve fibers, which are important for the sense of smell, but they're not actually the nerve itself. Those are the cells that actually your body can replenish and turn over, and much like our skin sheds over time, that's what dandruff is a replacement of our skin, our scalp, is the rest of our body similarly replaces cells. And those cells have the ability to replace. And we think, again, over the course of a month or two, as those cells get replaced, sense of smell recovers. If you damage the actual nerve fibers or the actual nerve cells, they have much less ability to truly recover. And we have concerns that either the first type of cell I mentioned is so damaged it can't recover, or those nerve cells themselves got damaged, and that's what's generating the very long-term smell loss.
We only have about 30 seconds left, Doctor. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Just read an article over the weekend about a woman who has experienced long-term loss of smell. She was trying her best. She was doing things to try to get it back. Do we know if there's anything that can be done to bring smell back?
Yeah, so there actually is some good evidence that something called olfactory retraining or smell retraining can work. And it's simply really having four or five very strong, distinct odors. People oftentimes use lemon, cloves, eucalyptus, rose smells, essential oil type smells. And twice daily, breathe these in for 20 seconds each. And over the course of 3 months, there's about a 30% rate of significant improvement in sense of smell by doing that retraining.
So there is some optimism or some hope for those who have lost that sense of smell. Interesting topic. Dr. Jonathan McGinn is a professor of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery with Penn State Hershey. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.